Blog Talk Radio.
With our good friend, Mary Castle. Everybody, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, June 24th, and today we're going to be chatting about the Battle of Britain with our good friend Barry Jacobson. We're going to be looking at World War II as we look at this particular segment of World War II. The last time we left it, when we left you the last time, we were talking about Paris collapsing, and now we're talking about the Battle of Britain, which is one of the amazing battles of World War II. So let me say hello to my good friend Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am well, Silvio. Thank you for asking.
Well, tonight, not only do we have some of your excellent commentary, but you're also going to share some audios with us, which I'm looking forward to at different times during the program. You're going to be sharing some audio with us. So I think that's going to be that's going to add some reality, if you will, to the program, Barry.
Yes, we are moving into the next phase of our discussion. As you mentioned, the Battle of France had ended and the Battle of Britain was beginning. This is a battle that Churchill would describe as not as the beginning of the end, but as the end of the beginning. And it's very well put, as only Churchill could put it.
Yes, absolutely. And you're going to be featuring... twice we're going to be hearing from Churchill tonight during the program. But I wanted to just go back, as we like to do on this day in history, just quickly. It was this week in 1940, actually yesterday, June 23rd, 1940, that after the collapse of France, that Hitler took like a little victory lap, if you will, inside of Paris. I thought it was interesting. It kind of fits in with our topic of last week, Barry.
Yeah, and in fact, there's a famous piece of footage which shows Hitler doing a jig that we now know was sort of an optical illusion that was used by the Allies as propaganda. Hitler was walking with several of his advisors and military staff to meet with the French government officials to sign the surrender documents in which France would surrender, and he was simply walking forward, but they played with the camera, the British did, and they made it look like instead of walking, he was actually dancing, dancing a little jig. He never did, but it sure looks that way, like he was doing a little victory dance.
Yeah.
And, of course, he's smiling while he's doing it, so it really lent itself well to British propaganda.
I always got the impression that Hitler was a bit of a stiff, what we would call a stiff today, not what you would call the kind of guy that you would have a good time at a party with. Would I be wrong?
No, I don't think he would be. I don't know about stiff, but certainly he was a serious individual. I don't think anybody's ever mentioned Hitler having, the Führer having a great sense of humor, for instance, or being the life of the party. He was a vegetarian. He was kind of a health nut up until the point where he became addicted to drugs that were prescription drugs that his doctor gave him towards the end of the war. That mostly because of the attempt on his life that frayed his nerves and probably caused some brain damage. But we'll get to that later when we get into our discussion of the war and get to 1944. But generally, he was a serious individual, and he was very intense. And obviously, he was very committed to what he believed in. So I would say you're probably right. He was not the life of the party.
No, not the kind of guy that you would sit down and have a lot of small talk with. Wouldn't be the kind of guy that you probably enjoy going to a ball game with, because he would either be very boring or very intense in the game. One way or the other, he probably wouldn't make very good company. Why don't you take a minute, Barry, and set up where we are up to this point and where we're going to go tonight?
Okay. Yeah, we just backtracking a bit to what we discussed in the past, the war breaks out in 1939, and it begins with the Germans overrunning Poland. We talked about that earlier. This was after a policy of appeasement in which the Allies tried to, Allies being France and Britain, America being out of it at this point, wanted to stay out of any more European conflicts. But France and Britain, which were the major powers in Europe at the time, aside from the Soviet Union and Germany, they tried to appease Hitler by giving him what he wanted politically, and it didn't work. It just made him hungrier and more ambitious. Eventually, he attacks Poland, and that draws the rest of Europe into war. Now, at this point of the war, the Soviets, led by Joseph Stalin, have signed a non-aggression pact with the Germans and are busily taking bites out of Finland and the Baltic states. They've also taken a piece of Poland when Germany invaded Poland. They waited till the Poles were occupied, fighting the Germans in the west. Then the Soviets invaded from the east and took a piece of the country as well, sort of a backstab.
Yeah.
And then Hitler, should have been attacked by the Allies while he was busy in Poland, and instead what resulted was called the Schietzkrieg, in which the Allies just basically sat on their ass and did nothing. A phony war, it's often called. And that was from late 39 to early 1940. The French hid behind their Maginot Line, which was a fortified belt between Switzerland and Luxembourg, right along the German border, Franco-German border. The British were making plans to help Belgium should Belgium be attacked, and it was fully expected, of course, that Germany would do exactly what they did in World War I, which was to sweep through the lowlands of Belgium into northern France. And so the British and the French were basically going to deploy their mobile forces into Belgium and support the Belgian army. It was called the Die Plan because they were going to deploy their forces on the Dow River. Meanwhile, in early 1940, Hitler invaded Denmark, which didn't fight back, and he overran that country. And then he overran Norway, where the British tried to stop him but were defeated in a very swift campaign. He wanted to take Norway because Norway would be a great place to launch U-boats from. It would gain him access to the North Atlantic. And his overall strategy would be to starve Britain with a submarine campaign, much like the Kaiser had nearly done during World War I. So where we're at now is Hitler has invaded France in June of, or May of 1940, and with an amazing plan came up with by a guy named von Manstein, the Manstein Plan. They did exactly what the French and British didn't expect. They launched a concentrated panzer thrust, panzer being the name for their tanks. Panzer means armored in German. A concentrated panzer thrust by a general named Guderian, who's considered the father of panzer warfare. Also with him was a sub-commander named Erwin Rommel, who would later gain fame, and we'll talk a lot more about Rommel later. But the thrust through Dardanes Forest, which would be the scene of the Battle of the Bulge in 1944. They thrust through the Dardanes where they're least expected, because no one thinks tanks can operate in these mountainous, forested region. And the French defenses are very thin. And they reach the town of Sedan on the Meuse River, and supported heavily by aircraft, they're able to cross the river. And by doing so, they drive a wedge between the French and British forces in Belgium and the forces defending the Maginot Line to the south. And they cut off all the Allied forces in Belgium from France and drive to the English Channel, where they very nearly cut off the British army and its ability to retreat. The British do retreat in what's called the Miracle of Dunkirk. They are evacuated by civilian ships, leaving their equipment behind, and retreat back to Britain. And that leads us where we're at today, with France capitulating as the Germans drive south into France proper after the British evacuate. And Paris collapses, the French resistance collapses, and the Battle of France ends, and the Battle of Britain is about to begin.
Yes. And I just wanted to get this in before we get to the actual battle, because, you know, the one country that, you know, some would say may have been the country that made the difference in World War II, the United States, because of the military might of the United States. At this moment, in June 1940 as the Battle of Britain was starting, the United States was just getting into an election mode. And you had President Roosevelt, who was about to run for a third term, although that wasn't very clear in June of 1940. But and, of course, the Republicans were accusing, once the election got started, the Republicans were accusing FDR that he just wanted to get involved in World War II. And, of course, the FDR was saying, no, I'm not, even at one point saying he would never send troops to fight the war in Europe. But that's kind of where we were. We were trying to stay out of it. But at the same time, I think there was an understanding probably in the hearts and minds of those people who really knew what was going on that our involvement, Barry, was probably inevitable. We just didn't know when it would happen. But clearly the United States came to the assistance of England during the Battle of Britain when we provided military assistance to the Brits. So I just want to get that in there because the United States at this moment was not thinking about war, and most Americans probably had no idea that in 18 months there would be a war, Barry.
You're so right. And in fact, it was after the Battle of Britain, and as the war moved into the Africa campaign, which we'll talk about it on another installment, and Britain was nearly brought to its knees by the submarine campaign, the U-boat campaign, that Winston Churchill comes to the United States and basically his speech is, give us the tools and we'll do the work. And that led to Lend-Lease, which again we'll talk about in the future. But yeah, America at this point was an election. It was between Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was running with a guy named by the name of Henry Wallace, against the Republican, Wendell Willkie. And his running mate was Charles McNary. The Republicans were defeated, of course, and Roosevelt became the first American president to ever run and win three terms as president. Of course, he would go on to win a fourth term as well towards the end of the war. But America was not really interested in getting involved in another war in Europe. And there was a very strong anti-war sentiment running throughout the United States at the time.
Right, led by none other than Charles Lindbergh, the man who, or one of the many, I mean, not him alone, but there were many others who were against the war. We had a little technical mistake at the beginning of the show, technical problem, so I couldn't get to this, so I wanted to get to this quickly now before we get to the Battle of Britain, Barry. Something very important is also happening in Britain right now, 2016. It's not quite the Battle of Britain, but like the Battle of Britain of 1940, many would argue this is a battle for British sovereignty, defending the country from external influence. And do you see much of a connection there between the vote and the Battle of Britain in that sense, Barry?
Well, the connection, other than the fact that it's gauged, between Englishmen, it's a battle involving Englishmen, the main connection is that in both cases, the fate of Britain is really being decided. Maybe not quite as dramatically as it would have been had the British, lost the Battle of Britain. Churchill would call that, the fate of Britain, which if they'd lost would have ushered in a dark ages, is what how he termed it. That's not the case here. We're not talking about a choice between civilization and the dark ages, but we're talking about the fate of Britain. And the reason is because Britain, which before the European Union enjoyed its own Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth, which included all their old imperial possessions, Australia, New Zealand, India, Canada, Belize, all throughout the world, there was places where they spoke English, and they still do. And Britain had close ties. The Queen was still the Queen of those countries and acknowledged as such. And they had close trading ties, trading relations. And Britain was enriched by the Commonwealth. But when they joined the EU, they gave up the right to negotiate their own trade agreements. One of the reasons that they wanted to get out of the EU is that very reason. Their prosperity was being harmed. Not to mention their internal domestic politics or domestic affairs. The British Parliament, which is the mother of all parliaments, the mother of all democracies, the oldest deliberative legislative body in the world, was no longer making laws for Britain. They're being made across the channel in Brussels by a bunch of pointy-headed liberal regulators. bureaucrats. So now they can negotiate their own fate. They can go back to the Commonwealth countries. They negotiate new treaties with India. Their trade agreement with India, or they could not negotiate a trade agreement with India because apparently Italian tomato growers had shot that down in the EU because they couldn't compete with tomatoes from India. So, you know, there was no trade agreement with India between Britain and India because of that, which is just nonsense. And so Britain can go back now, okay, and to these countries that speak English and have a British, you know, link, and we'll have very, an advantageous position from which to negotiate trade agreements of their own. So all the doom and gloom about Britain is just overblown completely.
Right.
I think Britain is going to do just fine under this new reality.
I think you're right. If for no other reason, they have the fifth largest GDP in the world. I mean, when you have a GDP that big, when you're that big of an economy, that big of a country, you know, one way or the other, you're going to be just fine. You've got a lot of trading to do. You have a lot of buying and selling to do, and you're going to be fine. I think some of these predictions that the world would come to an end are nothing but a lot of people who are maybe bitter by the results. I mean, there are going to be adjustments. Let's not kid ourselves, but it's not the end of the world. I tend to agree with you. I think they're going to be just fine. We're going to take a little break, Barry, and then when we come back, we'll have a whole segment on the Battle of Britain. We'll hear the audios as well as your story of the Battle of Britain. We'll be right back. Okay, Barry, let's get started. You're on, as they say.
All right. Well, you know, the best way to start the Battle of Britain is with the man whose words I can never hope to emulate or match. You know, Winston Churchill, one of the great orators of modern history, addressed his own nation on the eve of the Battle of Britain, and this will take about a minute and a half, but this is what he said is one of his most famous speeches.
The Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. Oh, glory and strength of the enemy must very soon return on us. Eternal. That you will have to break up into islands or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, our lands may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit grounds. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more perverted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves against the British Empire and its Commonwealth's last for a thousand years, men will still say,
this was their finest hour. Indeed, it would be.
Yes.
The British were facing invasion. The Battle of France had ended, and Hitler had given his army, his generals, orders to prepare for the invasion of Britain. This was to be called Operation Sea Lion, and involved massive transportation of the Wehrmacht, the German army, onto British soil, and for the Blitzkrieg to continue in Britain. However, there was a slight problem. The problem was that Britain had the largest navy in the world, and the English Channel separated Britain from France. So there was no way Hitler could contest the channel with his own navy. His navy was just no match for the British. But he had one, he thought, one ace up his sleeve, and that was the Luftwaffe, which was the German Air Force. The German Air Force had gained complete dominance in the Battle of France. It had outnumbered the British, and it had helped gunned the French Air Force, having much better planes, mostly the Messerschmitt Bf 109 being the main fighter plane of the German Luftwaffe. And so Air Marshal Goering, the Reichsmarshal Goering, the head of the German Luftwaffe, was given orders to clear the channel of British planes and then British ships. So they'd first wipe out the British Air Force, and then within 16 days, clear the channel of the British Navy. And in the process, of course, wipe out British ports and air facilities in southern Britain. And this, of course, would open the way for the landing craft to then cross the channel unopposed and land the German army in Britain. So that's the stakes of the Battle of Britain. That's the setting for it. It begins at the very end of June. That's when Churchill made that speech. Though officially, the Battle of Britain begins on 10 July 1940, and it will go through early September, with the height of the battle being in the midsummer of 1940. Now, from the very beginning, the Germans are laboring under two handicaps, which will become decisive in this battle, and thank God for it. The first one was that the Germans never had a cohesive strategy that they stuck to, and that's because they had Hermann Goering at the head of the Luftwaffe. Now Goering occasionally got the job done, as he had in the Battle of Sedan, when he helped Goering to cross the River Meuse. But more often than not, his promises were overblown, and he was never able to fulfill those promises. He was not ever able to gain dominance over the English Channel. And that was the biggest problem, is his strategy kept changing. From first was to knock out the British Air Force, and then shortly thereafter, he began attacking British airfields. And then shortly after that, he changed the directive to have the Luftwaffe attack British cities in sort of a terror campaign, which became known as the Blitz, and would in fact continue on for another year. That was the bombing campaign that you saw, London in flames and great destruction of civilian targets. But by doing that, he distracted his own air force from their main objective, which was to clear the channel. So that was the first disadvantage the Germans had. They had Goering in charge. The second one is they didn't have radar. The British had radar installations set up along the cliffs of Dover and other places along the English Channel, and they could see the Germans taking off from their airfields in France and gaining altitude long before they ever reached the Channel, and were able to then vector in their fighters to intercept. Now, the British were using the Spitfire, the Supermarine Spitfire Mark I, which was their best dogfighting aircraft. It was roughly complementary and about on the same par as the Bf 109, the German aircraft. They were about on a par. The difference was the battle was being fought over Britain. So when German planes were shot down, in about equal numbers initially to the British, their pilots were either captured or killed. Whereas the British, when their planes were shot down, the pilot would parachute out. He'd land on friendly territory. He'd be trucked or driven right back to his airfield, and within a day or two, he was back in the plane, a new plane.
Right.
So
that's a big difference, you would think, is you're not, a pilot is not something you make overnight, if you know what I mean. It takes probably years to develop a pilot, so if you could just get another one back in the game, that's a pretty good deal.
It was, and in fact, one of the things that's also kind of fascinating about the Battle of Britain is that the British civilians, and in fact, foreign civilians as well, like the Queen of Belgium, they actually took up collections, and villages would buy planes to donate to the Air Force. Spitfire ran about 5,000 pounds. The Queen of the Netherlands bought, I think, 48 planes. She bought some like 125,000 pounds worth of planes. So the British had this extra source of funding, much like the miracle of Dunkirk, when the British civilians got in their private boats and they went off and basically rescued their soldiers. In the Battle of Britain, they started buying planes and donate them to the Air Force, which, nowadays when planes cost billions of dollars, it's kind of, you never see that. But back then, you know, 5,000 pounds was a pretty reasonable cost.
Sure.
For a fighter plane, a top-of-the-line fighter plane at that.
Let me ask you a very quick question. When you were talking about the Germans thought that their Air Force would compensate for the British Navy. I think that's what you said a few minutes ago.
That's
how,
right.
In 1940, today we think of the United States as the world superpower. A few years ago, or 20 years ago, it was the Soviet Union and the United States. In 1940, who was the superpower? Probably not the United States yet. When we were huge, but we were not there yet. Was Great Britain, the United Kingdom, the super military power of the world?
No, and that's a great question, Silvio. At the beginning of 1940, if you ask any military observer, if you go back and look at Jane's Fighting Ships, for instance, or any of the military journals of the day, the French Army was considered the premier army of Europe. It had the most modern equipment, it had the largest number. The Russians probably on paper had more numbers, and if we had known really what was going on in Stalin's Russia, we would have probably given the Russians that top honor. But the Russians were very secretive, and no one really knew what was going on there. But the French were considered to be the premier army of Europe, and Britain had since, at least the Napoleonic Wars, had the premier navy of Europe. The British Navy ruled the seas. You know, their famous song is, "Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the seas," or "Britannia rules the waves." The British were capable of carrying on a naval war, the fight basically the Germans in the West and a potential foe in the Pacific as well. And that would soon, of course, arise with the Japanese. The Japanese also had a very large navy and would give both the British, the Dutch, and the Americans in 1941 a terrific time. In 1942, up until the Battle of Midway, gives us a terrible time in the Pacific. So the premier powers would be France on land, Britain at sea, and then Germany was sort of the scrapper. You know, Hitler had come up with this new tactics. He had a corps of young officers like Guderian and Rommel who were coming up with brilliant new ideas of ways of fighting war, which really became the doctrine of combined arms that we use today. It was pioneered by guys like that, by the German generals. The British Army was small, but it was elite, and it always had been. It had been since at least the 18th century. Britain's strategy on the continent had always been to be the balancing force against either the Germans or the Russians or the French by aligning with whichever power was fighting the strongest power. So if the strongest power was Louis XIV, and he was fighting against the Dutch, the British would go help the Dutch. If it was Napoleon against the Austrians, then he would go help the British would go help the Austrians. They were a small but elite. But the German army, by 1940, by the Battle of Britain, the German army had defeated France and without a doubt was the best army in the world with the best officers in the world. And the German general staff was considered to be and had been for several generations the premier military staff in Europe, you know, planning staff.
So one wonders, you know, after that explanation, one wonders what World War II would have looked like if the United States had never gotten involved. I mean, it would appear to me that Germany would have won. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but Germany would have won because they were so superior to anybody else, not only in equipment, but in leadership.
Well, leadership in the military sense, but not the political.
Yes, I know.
Sense.
No, I know. I
and
understand. Not Hitler. Not Hitler.
Not
I mean,
Hitler.
The generals, yeah.
Yeah, and I've always said that Germans lost World War II because they had one German too many, that
right.
One German being Hitler.
That's right.
Had Hitler not been Hitler, had he been, say, Churchill, they would have won the war.
Right, right.
If he'd been anybody who just kept his fingers off of the army and let the army win the war for him, because Stalin was very much like Hitler. He was a dictator. Between the First World War and the Second World War, he became leader of Russia. And one of the early things he did was he purged the military of all its veteran leadership. And one of the reasons they took such a terrible drubbing against the Germans in 1941 and in 1942 in the early stages was because their officer corps had been decimated by Stalin's purges in the 1930s. So, but once the war began, Stalin let his generals do their thing. And Hitler never did. Hitler was always micromanaging.
Right.
So
and that proved to be disastrous.
War.
Yeah, that proved to be disastrous later on. Well, let's get back to the battle. I just wanted to ask you that question about the different military situations because it's fascinating.
So the Battle of Britain rages for several months. The peak of the fighting is in July and early August. By late August, it's winding down, and it's become apparent to everyone, even including Hitler, that they're not going to be able to clear the skies over the English Channel. Now, he won't call off officially. He won't officially call off Operation Sea Lion and the plans to invade Britain until September. But by August of 1940, the Battle of Britain is being lost by the Germans. Casualty rates are fairly significant. The British start the battle with about 1,900 aircraft. The Germans start the battle with about 2,500 for advantage. But by the end of the Battle of Britain, the British have only lost 544 aircraft to the Germans' 2,500 aircraft. The Germans lost as many aircraft as they started with, which is an amazing number. So the Germans take a real drubbing. One of the reasons they lose so badly is because instead of attacking the RAF when it was weak in the very beginning of the battle and continuing to hammer them and hammer their air bases so they had nowhere to refit their planes, Goering made that switch midway through the battle and began attacking civilian targets, the so-called terror campaign, which was known to the British as the Blitz. And by the way, it's important to note about the Blitz that when London was burning and buildings were collapsing and whole blocks were being destroyed by bombs, by German bombs, the royal family did not leave London, even though they were urged to leave. They stayed in Buckingham Palace and in the St. James Palace. The Queen Mother of today, I think she just recently died, Queen Elizabeth's mother, was then Queen. That was Queen Mary. And she was married to King George VI, who is, most people listening would probably remember him as Colin Firth in the movie The King's Speech. He was the one with the speech impediment. That was King George VI. The two of them, Mary and her husband George, stayed in the burning capital and helped fight fires. Well, they didn't help fight fires in the sense of driving fire hoses, but they would go to sites which were on fire, where people were refugees. They'd go down in the subways where people were huddled, and they'd bring comfort to the people and show them that the royal family was willing to take the same risks as the average Englishman and English woman. And that goodwill built up during the Battle of Britain, during the Blitz, has probably buoyed the royal family ever since, in the estimate of many Brits, and to this day why there is so much love for the royal family.
Right.
Despite the fact that there's a lot who think Britain should be a republic, they probably saved the monarchy by that action.
Right. Now, wasn't also the lady who's today Queen Elizabeth, I remember her, I remember seeing some pictures of her during World War II, where she was wearing like a lady's military uniform, you know, the skirt with, you know, the hat, what I assume was what British ladies would wear in the military. I mean, so she was at least, as you were saying, that they decided to, that they wanted to be there with the people, which I think you're probably right. It probably saved the monarchy. And you know, we see some of that right now with her, you know, with her grandsons, with both William and the other younger one, whose name I cannot remember right now. They served in Afghanistan, both of them. I think one of them actually served in Iraq. So, I mean, they were both willing to serve for their country. They didn't have to, but they did, Barry. And I think that speaks a lot of them as people. I always felt that way. Harry, that's who I couldn't think of. I couldn't think of Harry's name. Harry and William served in Afghanistan as well as Iraq.
That's right. And the British royal family always serves in the military in some capacity. The reason you see them wearing uniforms is not an affectation, as with so many other royal families. It's not that they were given some honorary position in the military. You know, you always see kings and so on wearing uniforms, and usually it's just an affectation or an honorary thing. But the British royal princes, they always serve in the military, actually doing military duty. Prince Andrew served with Prince Charles's younger brother, and Prince William's uncle, he served in the Falklands War as a Harrier pilot. So, yeah, that's a great tradition. Queen Elizabeth, by the way, was Princess Elizabeth, and she was 14 years old during the Battle of Britain. And, of course, would come of age during that war.
Right. And what's interesting, when they had the 70th anniversary of D-Day, you know, she was the only military officer or leader of the war who was still alive, who actually went to that ceremony. I thought that was very neat that she went and represented her military that way, Barry.
Yeah, she's quite she's sort of a living piece of history, isn't she? And
she really is, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I would have said I fear for the monarchy once she's gone, because I've never thought very much of Prince Charles, but apparently his children, you know, Diana and his children, William and Harry, they seem to be quite excellent chaps, as the British would say, and I think the monarchy is in good hands.
I think so. I think so. The monarchy may have other problems, but William and Harry are not among them. I think they're both really. Really interesting. I thought it was kind of funny, if I could just do a quick sideshow here with Prince Harry. He was in the United States recently, and he was talking to a bunch of kids at a school, and one of the kids said, "Hey, are you ever going to be the king?" You know, some like fifth grader, you know, in a school or something. And he looked at him and kind of laughed and said, "No, I can't quite do that. My brother would have to die." I guess he didn't say that, but I mean, that would be the only way, right? I mean, his brother would have to die in order for him to get in line, right?
No, his brother and his brother's child would have to die.
Oh, okay, all right.
Because,
so he's got two strikes against him.
Yeah, Kate Middleton has had a kid, you know, by William, and I think they've had actually a second child now.
Right.
And I'm drawing a blank as to what their child's name is. I can't remember what it is, but anyway, that's the heir after William.
George.
So there's Charles.
George, I think. George is the little baby, I think. I think it's George,
that's
the little
right.
baby. Yeah,
yeah,
I think
right.
that's
and,
who
and
it
you know,
is.
It,
yeah.
And keep in mind, too, that the way the British royalty has always worked is they had every member, every king has got to have an heir and a spare. And the spare is the other brother. You know, when if Charles would die, his brother Andrew was the spare. And if William were to die, his brother Harry was the spare.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty good gig, because both Andrew and Harry have really been able to kind of live it up.
Right, right.
Quite
yeah.
the ladies' men, which their brothers couldn't be.
Right. That's one of the benefits of not being in line to be king. You know, you get some benefits as well. Well, anyway, I just wanted to get you off on that, because I didn't mean to get you off on that, but I think Queen Elizabeth is really quite a lady. I very much admire her. Some of her children have not turned out to be very good, but she herself is quite a lady. So we're back to the Battle of Britain, and things are not going well for the Brits, I think.
Well, but they turned around, and as the Germans changed their focus again from destroying the British Air Force in the first few weeks, and Goering made the mistake of changing the tactics and attacking the British cities, the British were able to gain this ascendancy. They were able to start massively out killing the Germans, and as we've already mentioned, the Germans, when they lose a plane, the pilot is either killed or captured, and whereas the British, when their planes go down, they crash land either in Britain, or they parachute over Britain, and they're quickly back in a plane again. So their veteran pilots survive, and the German veteran pilots mostly die. And it's a huge blow to the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. A total of 1,977 aircraft were destroyed. Some 925 German pilots were captured. Another 735 were wounded, and an additional to all that, another 600 were missing and never identified. So it was quite a blow to Luftwaffe, and the Battle of Britain ends with the British RAF, the Royal Air Force, soundly defeating the Germans and protecting Britain from a German invasion in 1940, after which Winston Churchill made another of his great speeches. It's called the Never So Few speech. Here's just a small excerpt from it.
I greatly hope for every home in our
They just don't make them like Churchill anymore, do they?
No, they don't. And it's not just the words, it's the style, too, that really, I mean, I can see why he connected so well with people because of that style. I think England was blessed that at a moment like this, it was almost like Lincoln in the Civil War, that they had Churchill. I really believe that without Churchill, maybe it would have been different, Barry.
You know, it struck me today as we're listening to John Cameron, the Prime Minister
yes.
of England, basically just abdicate and go into town and resign, though he said he'll stick it out until a new government basically is formed. Just how different the leadership is. You know, Churchill took a lot of buffets. He was in the wilderness politically for decades. But he never gave up. And, in fact, he famously came to America and he gave a speech at, I believe it was West Point, though memory may not serve me well here. It may have been Harvard, but some American university, either Harvard or West Point, I'm pretty sure. He gave a speech and he came out and he only said one thing. He came out, looked at the audience and said, "Never give up," and walked off the stage. Because that was the whole, if you had to give an epitaph for Winston Churchill, that was his epitaph. Never give up. Britain could have surrendered, and Hitler wanted Britain to surrender after the fall of France. Hitler did not envision the British Empire being destroyed. Hitler wanted to humble France. It wanted a free hand in the East to attack Russia. And to do that, it needed Britain basically to bow out of the war and let him do it. His real ambitions were in the East against the Russians. And he had written himself in Mein Kampf that he thought the British Empire would be a stabilizing influence, keeping the Untermensch, as he would call it, the subhumans of the Third World in check, you know, ruling Africa and ruling Asia. So he didn't want to destroy the Brits. He wanted the Brits to surrender and acknowledge him as the master of Europe, much like Napoleon had a century before. He tried to get the British to do the same thing. And only Winston Churchill, I think, because of his grit and his bulldog determination never to give up, and his mastery of rhetoric, his master oratory, was able to infuse that fighting spirit that he possessed and that determination to fight on into the British people. And as you said, I don't think anyone else could have done it.
I agree with you, and one of the future shows, maybe when we get to the end and we summarize, I would like to look at the characters of World War II, the men and women who were in key positions, whether it was Churchill, whether it was obviously Hitler, but some of the men who basically were there during all that time, and I would include Roosevelt, Eisenhower, Truman, and some of the others, because I think that there was quite a collection of men and women who were in leadership positions at that time, who maybe everything would have turned out different if they had not been there. I mean, clearly Eisenhower was the right man for that job without question in my mind. And Truman was the right man in 1945, and of course Churchill in 1940 and for a few more years to go. So quite a group of characters. If this was a play, this would be quite a group of characters. And they all have their own little personality, too, which I think if you were making a play, it would be very interesting to play the character of Churchill or the character of Eisenhower and some of the others. They were all very interesting people in their own way, Barry.
And by the way, in the last show, you recommended a movie called
yes.
Young Winston.
Absolutely.
Which I'd seen before, but just interesting after you said that, it came on one of the premium channels. Came on, mm-hmm. I think it was Turner Movie Classics.
That's right, Turner Movie Classics,
And I was able to record it and see it again, and I was struck again and reminded just what an amazing job of capturing Churchill, the actor Simon Ward, who plays young Churchill, and then somebody in the background who's sort of a voiceover, the older Churchill talking mm-hmm. about, his younger self. Right. Who also does an excellent job. If anybody who's interested in Winston Churchill, there's many films out there about him. I know Albert Finney has played him in The Gathering Storm.
Yes.
Brendan Gleeson played him in the movie Into the Storm. But I think you have to see that one as well. You have to see young Churchill.
You're right. You have to see him to understand where he came from. His American mother, who is played beautifully in that movie by, I can't think of the lady's name, but she does a beautiful job playing.
Anne Bancroft.
She's absolutely, I mean, she's not only a beautiful woman, but she plays a beautiful role of Jean Randolph Churchill, I think it was the lady's name, Churchill's mom. And then at the very end of Young Winston, of course, we're introduced to Clementine, not too much, just a little bit, the lady that would go on to be his wife and first lady of England. But you're right, that is one of those movies that it's not a World War II movie, but it's the story of one of the characters of World War II. I have always loved that movie. I watched that movie. I have maybe watched that movie 20 times. Whenever it's on TV, I make an effort to watch it if I can. I have rented that movie. I mean, it's just one of those movies I don't get tired of watching. I mean, it's just fantastic. I don't know how else to describe it. I don't know if it won any awards, but if it was up to me, it'd be one of the great movies of all time, you know. But then I have a little different taste, and a lot of people do, Bear. I don't have the same taste as the Hollywood experts do. I have my own taste when it comes to a movie, you know.
Well, I think your taste is much better than most Hollywood so-called experts.
Yes.
Who the stuff they watch is rather, and like to watch is rather, rather lost on me. But, you know, here's a couple of interesting facts about Young Winston, the film. An actress who made her initial appearance in film in that movie, playing Pamela Plowden, who is Winston Churchill's first love, is a young actress by the name of Jane Seymour, who, of course, went on to great fame in film afterwards. So that was her first film. And another interesting point of that movie was Anne Bancroft, who played Churchill's mother. She is the same actress who went on to play in the movie The Graduate. Actually, had already played in the movie The Graduate, Mrs. Robinson.
Remember that famous song,
Mrs. Robinson, by Simon and Garfunkel.
Right. This would have been about 10 years before, I would think.
That's right. That's about
10 years before, yeah. Yeah. I forgot about that connection to Mrs. Robinson and Mrs. Churchill.
Yes, well, that's why you have me.
That's right. That's why you have me, to connect me to a great song and a great movie there. But no, you're right. She did a great job in both. And you're right. Simon Ward was just an absolutely, you know, he couldn't have been, you think of a young Churchill, you think of Simon Ward. In fact, there is a picture of a young Churchill. There's a book with a picture of young Churchill. You can Google some of his pictures of young images of Churchill. And Simon Ward actually does look a lot like him as a young man in his early 20s, Barry.
He's pretty much a spitting image, isn't he?
He really is. It is amazing, the casting job that they did there.
Well, Churchill, as he got older, he became a rotund, and certainly in the face, he became rounder face. But when he was a young man, he was a cavalry officer. He'd gone through the cavalry school at Sandhurst. And he fought in the Boer War, though as a correspondent. He served in India as a cavalryman on the northwest frontier, where he saw action against mountain tribesmen. And he was at the Battle of Omdurman, where he took part in the last great cavalry charge in British history, in which the 21st Lancers charged into a trap laid by the Dervishes. There was a horde of sword and spear wielding Sudanese in a gully, and the Lancers charged right into this gully, and Churchill was in the thick of it. So the guy was he was no mere politician. He was a soldier and really quite a great military mind. Though he made mistakes, and they all make mistakes, many of his plans were bold and well thought out, and often only failed because of the poor execution by his generals.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, give us a little tip about the next episode.
Well, the next episode was supposed to be moving into the Battle of North Africa and the Africa Corps, Rommel and the Africa Corps, which would be the next stage chronologically We can do that, or we can take a break and do an episode on the leaders, which you just talked about, and talk about the personalities we're going to be meeting in the episodes to come. And we can
do either one, whichever order
you like.
Yeah, why don't we do the leaders? Because I think that way we set that up. Because I'm just fascinated by these people. I mean, this was such a – I mean, I'm sure you can go back, especially you being a military historian, I'm sure you can go back and find moments where there was such a collection of leaders. But as far as I'm concerned, with my limited knowledge, this is about as a great a collection of men or characters as there ever was. I'm sure you may find some in your your historian archives. But World War II is pretty good, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, you have to go back probably to, the Punic Wars, between Hannibal and the Romans to find such a diverse and capable collection of both politicians and military leaders. And of course, it was the largest war in human history and being fought on in every part of the world. So it's not surprising we have such a large and interesting cast of characters. But so that'll be the next show. We'll do that next week.
That's right, and not only the biggest war, but by far the most deadly weapons, including the weapon that ended the war, the atomic bomb. So it was not just global, but the weapons were absolutely incredible. Well, Barry, as always, thank you so much for your information. I do apologize to you, Barry, and to some of the listeners, because there was a little technical problem at the beginning, but I think it was more with my voice than yours, so I think everybody got to hear you. But my voice, I think, was a little crooked for the first 30 seconds or so. So they didn't miss much. They got you. They missed me. I think that's a good deal.
Well, thank you. And I look forward to next week. It should be, as always, fascinating.
All right. Thank you so much. Barry Jacobson, my friend, military historian, military blogger, just an absolutely great friend of our show. And we'll continue our series of World War II. I know some of you are enjoying it. I've gotten some emails from you telling me that. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.